my client is Shadow Ridge Limited Partnership, and it is here today requesting that this court reverse the order of the County Court of Douglas County sustaining the motion of the estate of Wayne L. Ryan to dismiss a petition for allowance of claim. Not only did the county court sustain the motion to dismiss, but it also made a finding that no future potential amendments would be successful and dismissed the petition with prejudice, thereby rendering this a final order. Scope of your review, as the court knows, in this pleading stage case is de novo, and it will accept all of the allegations in the petition for allowance as true, including any reasonable inferences that may be drawn from those in favor of the non-moving party. The petition articulates two theories of recovery for its claim. The first is a written and signed pledge agreement by Wayne L. Ryan during his lifetime in August of 2016, and secondly, a theory of promissory estoppel. We contend that the county court either failed to apply the appropriate standard in its analysis of the petition for analysis, and its order of dismissal was premature, or it engaged in some fact-finding, which went well beyond the allegations in the petition for allowance. Its role at that time was to merely review the allegations and apply the plausibility standard, which requires that only Shadow Ridge allege sufficient facts to state a claim that is plausible on its face.
Counsel, at the time of death and at the time of assertion of the claim and the petition for allowance of claim, it's undisputed, is it not, that the condition specified in the agreement had not yet been satisfied?
That is correct. There was a contingency in the agreement.
And what difference does that make?
It makes none, because we're applying contract principles. And the contract in the form of the pledge agreement did have a contingency, which primarily involved the resolution of litigation by Wayne Ryan, between Wayne Ryan and his daughter and Streck, in order to generate additional funding.
If Dr. Ryan had still been alive and the condition had not yet been satisfied, you would not have been able to commence an action against him, would you?
That's correct, as against
Dr. what's the difference?
Ryan.
Why?
Because the estate is his alter ego, and the contract principles would apply. Also, the probate court clearly contemplates that claims can be submitted with contingencies, and in fact, the probate code allows for means of handling those contingencies, which could include reducing the claim to present value or creating a trust or other means to make future payments. So the contractual claim did not die with Dr. Ryan. In fact, it endured, and the probate code required that we specifically make this claim within the statutory timeframes after notice, which was done. And again, respectfully, the probate code provides for contingencies in terms of contract claims.
Pete, another thing I want to ask you about, with respect to your contract claim, the rationale of the county court and the arguments of your opponents seem to be that this was, in fact, a retroactive or retroactive inter vivos gift, and that's the reality, not a contract situation. And my question is, dealing with that argument, how do we consider the provision of the contract that said transfer taxes would be paid by your client? That sounds like a gift.
I think it's very clear that in the petition for allowance, which attached the pledge agreement, that there were specific terms. That was a form of consideration, Your Honor. However, I think that the law also supports the fact that consideration is not to be a means of analysis at the pleading stage. That is a factual question, and that consideration can even be in the form of a peppercorn. I think that the restatement of contract second has also stated that just because it may be in part a, the bargain may be in part a gift, is not fatal to the question of whether or not a valid contract has been stated. And certainly this court has rendered multiple decisions where pledge agreements were determined to be enforceable contracts. So I get back to the contract. I'm sorry.
Talk about that for a second. Other than this Illinois case where there was a pre-existing ownership in a golf course, which seems to me to be distinguishable, but just set that one aside. Are there any cases that you're aware of where a pledge agreement is enforced against or in favor of, rather, a for-profit entity?
There is not that I'm aware of in Nebraska.
And what does that tell us about pledge agreements?
Well, there are pledge agreements are to be construed as contracts. They certainly state the terms of a contract. The contract was accepted in this case. It was very specific and was attached to the petition for allowance. And there was consideration. And that clearly meets the plausibility standard at this pleading stage. And all are equal before the law, Your Honor, whether they're an individual or a for-profit or a non-for-profit. And there certainly is case law in this state, including the Couch decision, for example, the Griswold decision, several of them involving Nebraska Wesleyan.
All of them involve charitable or educational or what we would commonly think of as non-profit entities. And in fact, the Eighth Circuit case you cite also involved a college or university, even when it said charitable or other institution. But no court that I can find, and I'm looking for your help, has gone beyond that line to a for-profit institution on a contract theory.
Well, again, contracts,
right.
The fact that there is not the existence of a decision does not somehow negate the contract principles that are applied.
So you're urging us to lead the way in that way.
Well, I don't think that the court honestly would be leading the way, in my opinion, Your Honor. It would be simply following some well-worn legal principles that when you enter into a contract.
Let me ask this a little bit differently. Why should it make a difference whether the contract or the pledge was with a profit or non-profit organization?
I don't believe that it should make any difference because all are equal before the law, as I stated. And I find, conversely, Justice Castle, no case that says that a pledge agreement is not enforceable as it relates to a for-profit entity.
What should the probate court have done with this claim, in your opinion?
Well, the probate court, in a very short order, simply said that apparently applying the analysis that this was actually an inter vivos gift, they should have overruled the motion to dismiss and they should have allowed this case to proceed. And the order made no mention of the promissory estoppel theory either. It made no disposition of it. The court, in its very brief order, actually acknowledged the existence of the pledge agreement, yet went on to say that it was in the nature of an inter vivos gift, which is not supported by any of the allegations in the petition for allowance. So it should have simply overruled it and allowed the case to proceed, and that's precisely what I'm here asking that this court do,
but could
reverse and remand it.
Could the probate court order the estate to pay that those sums out?
Well, the court should have allowed the case to proceed to determine whether or not the petition for allowance should have been.
Which ultimately honored. Would be requesting the payment of the $20 million.
That is correct.
But would the probate court had any authority to do that with these contingencies in place?
Well,
the settlement of the lawsuit, the sale of the stock, would the probate court have done anything?
Well, they could have, Your Honor, and I believe that we cite the probate provisions in our briefing. that would allow the court to do a number of things when there are contingencies in contracts. And this is not unusual that there is a future contingency for performance in a contract. I believe that I...
One last, I have one more question, and that is it a fair reading of your petition for allowance of claim that because the conditions have not been met, none of the amounts pledged by Dr. Ryan have been paid? Is that a fair reading?
It is a fair reading, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
And that, in fact, is true. I believe I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is it Mr. Mitchell Hassan?
Just Hassan, Your Honor.
Mr. Hassan, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. May it please the court, my name is Cameron Hassan, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellee in this case, the estate of Dr. Wayne Ryan. This appeal does involve the resolution of the question of whether the county court correctly dismissed the petition for allowance of claim of the appellant Shadow Ridge Limited Partnership, who I'm going to be referring to as either Shadow Ridge or the appellant throughout this argument. And Your Honors, I want to make it very clear that there's only one would-be promise at issue in this case, and that's the promise that is memorialized or set forth in the pledge agreement that's found in the transcript beginning on pages 27 through 30. So the county court did recognize that's what the claim was based on, and it did dismiss the claim. This court should affirm the county court's decision for three independent reasons, the first of which is that the plain, unmistakable language set forth in the pledge agreement makes it clear that at best the document was a donative document that is memorializing an intent to make a future gift. The second reason is that agreements such as this are not enforceable, and they should not be found enforceable as a matter of sound public policy. And the third reason is that there were unquestionably multiple conditions precedent that have not and are not likely, or at least one of them is not likely to be occurring prior to this issue. Yes,
Your Honor. Let's talk about the conditions argument. We're not in the realm of Shadow Ridge suing Dr. Ryan. We're in the realm of Shadow Ridge asserting a claim against Dr. Ryan's estate. And doesn't the probate code, section 30-2492, expressly contemplate claims that are in fact conditional in nature?
Well, that section, Your Honor, actually splits into two different subsections. Section A says that a contingent claim that actually becomes due may be paid out. That unquestionably has not happened in this case. So that leaves subsection B. Shadow Ridge has not asked for subsection B specifically to be applied, which is a discretionary relief for the trial court to be able to determine if, depending on the expectancy to pay out a claim. And, Your Honor, to even get to that point, the court would first have to find that there was a viable theory of relief in the first place, which goes back to the first and second arguments that I was just referring to. And regarding the first, that this is plainly, that is a gift, Your Honor. The plain language demonstrates that. So this court has held numerous times, including in Britain versus City of Crawford, found at 282 Nebraska 374, a party is not allowed to recast or reframe the true nature of a claim to make it into something it's not. So if someone were to come here and put a duck in front of me and have this duck, it waddles and it quacks and it looks like a duck.
But here we have the actual agreement in black and white.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And it says what it says.
Exactly, and I want to point out what it says. On page 28 of the transcript, it defines Dr. Ryan as the donor. On page 29, it says the donor is to provide gratuitous transfers. On page 30, in the express condition language, Your Honor already pointed this out when the appellant was arguing. I'm going to read a direct quote here. The transfer tax is attributable to the transfers contemplated by this pledge agreement's parenthetical gift taxes reportable on IRS Form 709 in parenthetical, so that the practical result of the intended transfers is that they will be properly characterized as a net gift for federal gift tax purposes.
Assume for a moment that we are accepting the argument that this is a pledge agreement and that we disagree that it's a retroactive inter vivos gift. Where does that take us with respect to the questions that I asked about for-profit, non-profit, art, previous jurisprudence about pledge agreements?
Sure, Your Honor. I think that goes straight to our second point, which is that agreements like this, especially in this context with the pretext of consideration set forth, are not enforceable. They've never been held to be enforceable before, and it'd be unsound public policy for this court to expand the law in order to create a newly viable claim. So,
well, there are numerous claims, numerous cases. Many of them happen to involve Nebraska Wesleyan University.
They do.
That did, in fact, enforce pledge agreements.
They do.
Why, if this is a pledge agreement, why is it not enforceable, albeit it may not be immediately enforceable, but implementing the second part of the contingent claim statute?
Sure, Your Honor. There's two reasons. I think the court already identified there is not case law out there that outside of the charitable or religious or educational context this has ever been held. And I think the
Are there cases holding that pledge agreements to for-profit entities are not enforceable, or is this just, or is it just people don't usually make pledge agreements to for-profit entities?
I don't think the cases exist, and I think the reason the cases don't exist is that there's other ways for this to happen. The statutes, and this is everywhere in the United States, this is what wills are for. This is what testamentary documents are for. This is what gifts causa mortis are for, and it's admitted by the appellants in their briefing. They are not seeking to have some sort of gift causa mortis. They are not seeking to recover on a testamentary bequest or legacy. That's the form that a private for-profit entity, if they were going to try to recover on some sort of intent to donate, that's the way to do it.
But can you point us to any cases where courts have said, no, we're not going to enforce this. This is a pledge agreement to a for-profit entity.
I don't think it's come up, Your Honor. I can't point to one because I don't think that it has come up. And I think Why should it make a difference, Your Honor? It's an exception for the religious, charitable, educational institutions. That is a benefit for the public good. And I don't know if it came up during the appellant's argument, but I think that it's unquestioned that the petitioner here is a private for-profit country club. It is not a religious institution. It is not Nebraska Wesleyan, which you're right, it does come up all the time for some reason in Nebraska. It's not Baker University. It is not...
If Mr. Locher were up here again, he'd be saying, but the donor here wanted to produce the finest golf course in Omaha. There's the quasi-public purpose of this is going to be a worldwide attraction for Omaha of this golf course. Why wouldn't that fit?
Well, a couple different reasons, Your Honor. I think that one of the reasons is that the consideration, it's real pretext. The court needs to look at transcript page 32. It's the cover letter of the proposal that was attached to the pledge agreement. And again, this is incorporated into the pleading. So the fact that there may be averments in the petition for allowance, those averments, if they're inconsistent with the language of the operative document that they're seeking to recover under, the averment shouldn't be given credit. And if you look at page 32, this cover letter, it's a letter from Mr. Shanahan that repeatedly thanks Dr. Ryan for Dr. Ryan's generosity in helping Mr. Shanahan achieve his goal to improve specific areas of the golf course that Mr. Shanahan has identified, and that this wouldn't be achievable without the generosity of Dr. Ryan. So I think that there is no factual averment that could be said that it is Dr. Ryan's intent that these things happen. It's plainly contradicted by the plain language of the document upon which they seek to recover. And on top of that, Your Honor, I think that it goes from the public policy application here. If the court were to create this new viable claim, then the practical effect on the county court, setting aside the decedent's estates in this state, but on the already overwhelmed county court system and probate court system, this would open the floodgates to allow a plethora of claims based on any pretext. Essentially, a long affiliation with someone. You can have a long affiliation with a mailman.
Before your time runs out,
yes, Your Honor.
I want to turn to, given that we're dealing with a dismissal based upon a 12b-6.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we have to treat all of the allegations of the complaint as true, and part of the allegations are that Shadow Ridge incurred expenses. Would you address why the even if we throw in with you on the contract claim, why the county court was correct at the pleading stage of tossing the promissory estoppel claim?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Nebraska law is unequivocal that in order to have a viable promissory estoppel claim, the reliance must have been reasonable and foreseeable. Like I said at the beginning in the introduction, there's only one would-be promise at issue here, and that's the one set forth in the pledge agreement. That pledge agreement has multiple conditions precedent before activating any duty to transfer. I'd identify the one that the appellants seek to avoid, which is the eventual sale of Streck Inc. to a third party for fair value. That condition keeps on going to say to enable the donor to have sufficient funds to be able to make the gift. So in essence here, the document says the donor cannot make the transfer until this condition happens. This is the pledge agreement, the promise that Shadow Ridge is seeking to rely on.
I'm not arguing that, sure. I'm not suggesting that on their promissory estoppel claim, they get the money right away. What I'm suggesting or asking you to respond to is the argument that the condition is dealt with under the probate code by bond or deposit or something along those lines, but that the claim of what they've actually incurred, if it turns out to be that they did incur anything, which we have to accept because that's what they pled, that doesn't go forward past the pleading stage.
Yes, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. May I answer the court's question and any other questions before? So with regard to that, Your Honor, again, the promissory estoppel claim requires reasonable and foreseeable detrimental reliance. The fact that the document says this transfer can never happen until the satisfaction of these two conditions, one of which may never occur. It's the equivalent of winning the lottery. How a third-party entity being sold to another independent third party for fair value, that is an express condition, and it would be unreasonable and unforeseeable as a matter of law to detrimentally rely on something which may never occur. That would be the same thing as me having someone tell me, I'm going to pay you $50,000 after I win the lottery, then have me go out and buy a, I don't know how much a Tesla is, I imagine it's expensive, $50,000 car, and then seek to recover on that when this person never wins the lottery. It's the equivalent. So in order to have a viable claim, it would have to be reasonable and foreseeable. And I would also note that if this claim could proceed past the motion to dismiss stage, any single person hoping to ever recover against an estate would only need say this was reasonable and foreseeable when in fact the plain language of the document upon which they're trying to recover says the exact opposite. Does that answer the question, Your Honor?
It is certainly an answer.
Thank you. Unless there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. If not, I ask that on behalf of the estate that this court affirm the county court's dismissal of the petition for allowance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.